ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
I'm science reporter Fiona Pepper.
And I'm Dr. Carl.
73 seconds after launch, something unthinkable happened to the Space Shuttle Challenger.
Obviously a major malfunction.
We could not believe what we were seeing. The Challenger Legacy.
Join us as we uncover what really happened.
Listen now by searching Science Friction on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Belle Smith, would you be surprised to learn that in 97 metro stations around Paris in France, there are large UNESCO posters celebrating our school kids' achievements planning urban forests?
Honestly, Robin, it's not something I've thought too much about. So yes, I would be surprised.
So was I, and delighted. But it's just some of the good news in this science show for 2026. Hello from me, Robin Williams.
And me, Belinda Smith.
And Belle, I'm looking forward to your follow-up in a couple of minutes to that question raised last week of the arrival of humans in Australia 45,000 years ago, or 65. First, a sad and unexpected farewell, vale, to a giant of Australian science. Professor Emma Johnston died last month after less than a year as the Vice-Chancellor of Melbourne University. But she left a legacy of superb work to help us tackle the future amid bad news about the collapse of biodiversity. If you and I link to local science centres, museums, branches of university, we can together, she found, make a real difference. Just to take you one example of good news that you gave is there is improvement in marine protected areas, especially where there's a link between the community and institutions with some sort of scientific base.
Yes, so what we've found in coastal ecosystems around Australia, and this is on the basis of a huge number of social surveys and ecological surveys combined together, is that when we get really good institutional policies that are protecting ecosystems, local communities respond. They value those ecosystems more. They do their own stewardship and protect them. And then there's a positive biodiversity response. So larger fish, more species richness of fish. So this is an example of fully protected marine parks, quite small sometimes, working very effectively. So that's an area where we've got alignment between policy and practice and people and place, and it's all working in a virtuous circle. When you talk about places like Antarctica, where there's no local coastal community, the big question remains, how do we protect remote areas where people aren't directly engaged in stewardship? And I think Antarctica is a fantastic example of how it can work, because Australians love Antarctica. They are deeply connected to it and they value it as a wild, pristine place that should be protected. The question is, will these values and this willingness to conserve Antarctica withstand the massive global changes that are happening? Right now, sea ice extent around Antarctica is the lowest that has ever been observed by a very, very large margin. So the ice shelves are melting and the sea ice is melting, and we will see dramatic changes in the ecology. We do stand to lose a lot of beautiful species and communities that I've dived on personally under 5 or 6 metres of ice and in minus 1.85 degrees Celsius. It's hard work, but it's worth it. You see these gigantic sponges as tall as me. You see anemones the size of dinner tables. And these are slow communities that have never been disturbed and they've just been sitting there quietly growing and shivering probably for many, many decades. They will be transformed by the sea ice being removed and outcompeted by algae as the light resource comes in. So another example of the speeding up of marine ecosystems.
The late Professor Emma Johnston, speaking at Government House in Sydney, she died in December, such a star in so many ways. Belle, last week on The Science Show, we mentioned the surprising statement in a rather good BBC TV series, Human, that people arrived in Australia 45,000 years ago, not 65. What have you found out this week?
Well, I spoke to Bastian Yamas, a geneticist specialising in ancient DNA at Adelaide University, and I asked him, Why do we have these two quite different dates for human arrival in Australia?
It's because it's coming from two different sources of information. So the long chronology, the 65,000 years, is coming from archaeological evidence. And then the other, what we call the short chronology, is mainly based on genetic data. So two very different sources of evidence.
So with the long chronology, what is that archaeological evidence?
So in the Northern Territory, there is this site called Majibibi, and some colleagues, Chris Clarkson has led the study, have dug in this rock shelter down to layers that were later dated to be 65,000 years. And in those layers, they found stone tools or evidence of human-made tools.
What are some of the arguments against that 65,000-year figure?
The context in Australia is that a lot of the sites, or most of the older sites, are always on the verge of 49,000-50,000 years, and that's across the country. And there is this one site that looks like an outlier because it's suddenly 65,000 years. And the debate was around accuracy of the dating, how the site was well dated throughout from the top to the bottom, with the top being the youngest period of time and the bottom being the oldest period of time. And then there could be some younger layers sinking below all the layers. There's been a lot of heated debates around the work that had been done at that particular site. And I think right now, people tend to accept the work that has been done. There's been enough criticism. These criticisms have been addressed. And right now, 65,000 years seems to be accepted, let's say.
And what about the 50,000 years? How do you trace that through genetics?
To estimate time, what we use is the accumulation of mutations along genetic lineages. Let's take a human population, for example, or several human populations. And then you try and count the number of changes in their DNA sequence between individuals and between populations. And then we apply what we call a mutation rate, and you can estimate how many generations ago two lineages split, for example. So it's based on this concept that some people have heard, which is called the molecular clock, whereby mutations accumulate at a constant rate over time. You have a rate, you have a number of mutations, and then you can deduct, if you want, the time since the split between two lineages.
Relies on the assumption that the mutation rate that you have is correct. The molecular clock is not beating too fast or too slow.
It is a big assumption indeed. The calculation of this mutation rate is based on observation that we do, looking at many, many different sequences from many different people. And there's been some global estimates, including all human lineages around the world. And much recently, there's been an understanding that maybe this global mutation rate doesn't apply to more local populations. So there's been people at the end of last year who published some work focusing specifically on New Guinea and Australia, so our region. And they started to determine that the mutation rate might be slightly different here. And it helped them reassessing the time when people started to arrive in New Guinea and Australia, and it matches now the long chronology. So the new data, the new molecular rate, and then suddenly a new time that matches perfectly what the archaeology is saying.
What would really clinch it? Would it be another 65,000-year-old archaeological site, or is it just a matter of building up little bits of evidence here and there to build a bigger picture of human migration in the region?
The more observations we make, the less disputed this one outlier becomes. Because, it's, of course, we have now a dozen sites that are matching the 65,000 years. It's going to be a hard call to go against it. As for the genetics analysis, it's the same. There is this one study that has shown that genetics could match archaeology eventually. Now it's a matter of replicating this, maybe using other populations, maybe using other methods. And once we have an accumulation of evidence coming from different sources using different methods, then we become very confident.
That was Bastian Yamas from Adelaide University. It's an exciting field of research, Robin, and who knows what new discoveries lie just around the corner.
Thanks, Bill, and stand by for much more this year on the longer presence in Australia of the human footprint, the Science Show on Radio National. And so to the good news, so much being done, not least in the West. Let's start at Curtin University, where the Vice-Chancellor has presided over a spectacular parade of achievements, often in conjunction with other campuses and centres there. I first met Harleen Hayne in Dunedin. How much do you miss New Zealand?
I miss New Zealand a lot. I lived there for 30 years, so in some ways it's still my home, but I'm really enjoying living here in Western Australia.
What helped you settle in this vast state?
So I came here sight unseen because I arrived during the pandemic. And I think one of the things that really helped me settle is that on the first day that I arrived at Curtin, I felt like somebody handed me this beautifully wrapped gift. And every day I come to work and I unwrap another layer and find something truly amazing inside. So this is a pretty amazing university in a pretty amazing state.
And I must say, I keep coming back here because the science is so good. The things you do here keep astounding me. The effort in astronomy is just spectacular, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. So we're also home to the SKA here in Western Australia, which is a radio telescope network, and we're part of a really important worldwide node trying to discover the origins of the universe.
Yeah. Square kilometre array. What stage does that reach now? Is it open yet?
Parts of it are open. It will actually not be fully open for many years, but there are hundreds of radio telescopes in the northern part of this state as part of the Dark Sky Initiative, and we have world-class researchers here at Curtin who are constantly monitoring signals from millions of years ago.
And of course, one of the points about that is you're getting so much information that you have to have some of the computing power that is the biggest in the world, who knows?
It is, absolutely. And that computing power also generates a huge amount of heat, so it also has to be cooled. It's a very technical operation, but it is absolutely spectacular. And I think one of the other really important features of the Square Kilometre Array here in Western Australia is that it's being done in collaboration with the Indigenous people on that land. So they have worked very extensively with the researchers. They are also telling their own Indigenous stories of the sky, which has led to a very rich narrative that we're being able to tell from both a modern scientific perspective, but also from the perspective of people who have lived here for tens of thousands of years.
So what sort of assistance can they give, apart from their own cultural history? Technical?
Absolutely. And so many of the people who work up there on the Square Kilometre Array are from Indigenous communities. They also help our researchers to survive in what is not a very friendly atmosphere or climate. And they can tell stories. And those stories have become an integral part of our work here at Curtin with respect to the SKA.
And of course, I know about Phil Bland, who actually came from Britain and leading a team who are looking at the ways in which very large rocks from outer space keep landing on the Nullarbor and elsewhere and being found and analysed by you. It's incredible.
When I first arrived at Curtin, we were locked down in Western Australia. And so I had the opportunity to spend a lot of time with researchers here because I couldn't go anywhere else. And his team were obviously some of the people that I spent a lot of time with. And one of the really interesting things that I discovered in that beautifully wrapped gift was the development of BINAR, which is a little CubeSat satellite that was totally designed and built by researchers and students here at Curtin. And that BINAR program is continuing on. And again, it's about making satellite technology available to a wider group of people. It's affordable, it's reliable, and the program is continuing here.
Yes, I was wondering about what is your secret? Obviously, hiring the best people is a good start, but do you have more money than other campuses? How's it working?
Well, I mean, I don't think we have more money than other campuses. In many ways, Curtin probably has less money. I think one of the key features to success here is, you know, we lean heavily into our namesake, John Curtin. He was the 14th Prime Minister of Australia. He led the country through World War II. But there are other things about John Curtin that are probably less well known. He was the shy son of Irish immigrants to Australia. He left school at the age of 13, and he really struggled, both with mental and physical health problems throughout his life. He was elected to Parliament, but it took him four tries to get there, and he eventually became the Prime Minister in 1941. And so many years later, he still is Australia's most trusted Prime Minister. But Curtin had a number of really strong beliefs that we hold here at Curtin University today. He believed that everyone who aspired to an education should have the opportunity to pursue one. And he really believed in the transformative power of education to change individuals, families, communities, nations, and the world. And so I think it's that underlying ethos that has really been a strong contributor to our success. We do believe that everyone deserves a chance, and by hook or by crook, we're going to be able to solve some of the world's greatest challenges.
Does the rest of Australia and that part of the world further on know about this ambition and success?
Well, what's interesting, when I came to Curtin, people often described Perth as being the most isolated capital city in the world. The reality is, it's only isolated from the rest of Australia. We actually sit in the center of the Indian Ocean. We share the same time zone with 60% of the world's population. So although Australia may not necessarily be aware of all of what we're up to, other parts of the world truly are.
This is precisely why I came to see you, and because it was the feeling I had, because when I'm reading the successes and the publications and going from geology and obviously astronomy, and we've talked about medicine and various other things like that, the zest is fantastic, but you wouldn't know it out east so much.
No, absolutely not. But I mean, we are a big feature in the Indian Ocean Rim. I guess the other thing that many people don't realize is that although our largest campus is here in Australia, Curtin University also has bricks and mortar campuses in five other countries outside of Australia. So we are trying to tackle the problems in our part of the world. And I think we've defined our patch as the Indian Ocean Rim. So we've established campuses in Malaysia, Singapore, Dubai, Mauritius, and Sri Lanka, and now all of those countries are part of our larger Curtin family.
The same sort of story at Murdoch University last night when there were some alumni, including the Premier, who talked about the fact that he flourished, much to his surprise, by being involved with student politics, and now he is a leader in the state, of course. And also, and this is another surprise, a fellow of the Royal Society of London and a professor at Oxford, who in fact could get in only at Murdoch because they were willing to give him a go. And then he flourished.
Absolutely. And we have hundreds of stories like that at Curtin as well. And again, it goes back to our namesake, that believing that everybody who wants to have an education should have one. One of the things we've been really successful at Curtin is recruiting students to study STEM subjects. So across all of our campuses, we've got about 65,000 students. And of those 65,000, 23,000 are studying something in STEM. And when you look at world trends where people are having difficulty getting people into STEM, where kids are rejecting science in high school, we've got to reflect on how we've been so successful in drawing so many of those students here at Curtin. And I think there's probably two keys to our success, and one relates to giving everyone a go. So in other universities where I have worked and studied in my life, there's been one front door to the university, and it's largely been highly competitive, and it's been based on grades or test scores, and only the best will be granted entry. At Curtin, we take a different approach. We've got about 30 front doors to this university. We do attract the best and the brightest students from Western Australia, but we also teach into the prisons, providing education to the most vulnerable in our community. And every student along the way is equally important to us. So we provide lots of pathways for individuals who have not yet found their way or who have lost their way to come back into the fold and to get excited about STEM. And I think the other thing that has been a really important key to our success is our outreach and aspiration raising. We make science really fun, and because we have all these students here who are studying science, they're great ambassadors for us. They support and maintain the most amazing robot competition every year through the Western Australian schools, where kids come together and build a robot and compete here on our campus in a major event that now has standing room only. Similarly, we've got girls in engineering. So lots of ways of getting people to see themselves in the future of science.
That's very interesting because as we read the newspapers of the last year, with departments being closed down, struggles to get enough geologists, as we had the person from the University of New South Wales not long ago in the science show saying departments are being closed, certainly at Macquarie University, etc. The picture looks at a distance fairly bleak, and of course the Academy of Science President Professor Jagadish has talked about the scientific support from Canberra being 1.6 of GDP, whereas with the competitors, other nations, it's 2.2, and even up to the successful ones I've said before on the science show, my apologies, up to 4% of GDP plus.
But it can't stop us from getting on with the job. And in fact, we have so many science students right now. We're currently constructing a brand new super science building on our campus. We're bursting at the seams. We're teaching chemistry literally around the clock right now. So we've made the call and people have answered that. It is really important for all of us to understand that universities play an incredibly important role. You know, we're important for society. We're the drivers of the economy, particularly here in Western Australia, where mining drives the Western Australian economy and Western Australia drives the Australian economy. We really do need people who understand geology and engineering and all the things that are going to be important for us making a transition to a cleaner, greener world. And I think we've been able to generate a huge amount of enthusiasm here at Curtin for those kinds of initiatives. We do want to be part of a carbon-free world. And our students understand that if they're going to make an important contribution, they're going to have to study science.
Professor Harleen Hayne, brimming with enthusiasm for Western Australia and for science. But what about those pupils in Australian schools celebrated all over Paris? This example comes from Murdoch University, and here is Dr. Gray Coupland, herself a finalist twice for Eureka Prizes for leading efforts in Perth to plant urban forests.
Well, the cool one is that the Miyawaki Forest Program was featured in 97 Paris subway stations as one of two UNESCO Green Citizens programs that featured. The other was on mangrove systems. Out of 150 programs across the world, they picked, which was a big honour, and I was very proud.
Congratulations, Gray. That's superb. And what about coverage of the activity? Much going on in Australia now?
Yes, the Miyawaki Forest Movement has really grown in Australia, which is absolutely fantastic. So as part of the program, we've now planted 22 forests across Perth and surrounds, which is really good. And 17 of those are in schools, which is excellent. So the more kids we can engage in climate action and get their hands dirty, the better.
Outside Perth, where else around Australia?
We've got quite a few in New South Wales. The Groundswell Collector's doing excellent work there. Canberra, of course. There's some going on in Adelaide. I'm planting one next year in Sydney, which is really fun. So lots of action.
Given that there's a problem with housing, do they sometimes say, well, why should we dig that up and have all sorts of trees there growing? Why don't we have houses there? Because the cost of land is such that got to make it pay. Don't you have those real estate difficulties?
Oh, yes. Well, you're probably well aware that Perth is the longest city in the world, over 150 kilometres long, north to south. I know, shocking.
I had no idea.
Absolutely shocking. In fact, there's a really good documentary that's come out called The Longest City, and it's just won some awards. It's a fabulous film. But, of course, that has come at the expense of our Banksia woodland community, which is now recognised as an endangered plant community. And unfortunately, when developers go out in Perth, they tend to bulldoze everything. It's quite shocking. So you see a lunar landscape with these new housing developments. So the idea is to stop that urban sprawl and to infill. That would be the best option. And the brilliant thing about Miyawaki Forest is that if there's any vacant area of land, you know, you can put a small forest in, be it the size of a car parking spot or a couple of hundred square metres. And that land is maybe unused. It's just an empty grassed area, and it can be teeming with life within a few short years.
And still the enthusiasm of the young primary school kids?
Oh, 100%. So what's fantastic is now I now have a PhD student who's looking at the well-being effects of engaging with the program with the school kids. She's doing fabulous work in those Ceballos. And in fact, this morning we were out at East Butler Primary School interviewing some year 4 and 5 students, seeing how well they are engaged with the program, the well-being outcomes, how connected they are with nature, what they're doing outside of school, and if the program's inspiring them to do extra things that they perhaps wouldn't be doing, or discovering extra things that they probably wouldn't be aware of.
Last time we discussed the problems of getting kids out of school, in other words, with permission and insurance and all that sort of thing, so on, what do you do?
Well, the brilliant thing about the forest that we plant in schools is it's all in school grounds, so we don't need any permissions to go on excursions or anything. It's entirely an incursion, which is fabulous. Often the areas we are rehabilitating are grassed areas, and sometimes we do actually find builder's rubble, wire, glass, you name it, underneath that grass. So before the forest goes in, we have to spend quite a few days rectifying those issues and rehabilitating the soil, rejuvenating the life before the kids could get there. And hopefully it's all ready for them to go when they come do their planting.
I suppose kids have been playing outside in street-type places for generations. Most of them survive.
Well, I certainly survived. I spent most of my childhood outside across the road in a bushland that we had opposite our place, you know, going in there with my sister and my dog. It was fabulous. I wish more kids would do that.
Where have you been this morning?
This morning we were actually at East Butler Primary School, where we were doing the forest monitoring with the kids. We had years 2 and 3 and years 4 and 5. Fabulous kids. These are kids that actually don't have any native vegetation on their school grounds, so their forest is now 2.5 years old, and we have amazing eucalypts in there. We have banksias, we have cocky's tongue, yakuljas, which is flowering and producing these incredible seed pods. We have this listed species in there called Dodonea hackettiana, which is a listed species also, so not very common in our native bushland, and it's absolutely bursting with seed pods. So absolutely fabulous. And in one of the schools, in fact, where we have this species as well, we have got these little seedlings popping up all over the forest. So recruitment is happening. So good to see.
And also young people who are hearing all sorts of warnings about the future state of the planet and so on, getting more and more down, thinking, what can I do? They're now doing it. Is that making a difference to their state of mind? You said that someone's actually studying that sort of thing.
So this is what Inez is studying. She's seeing, you know, what impact the forest program will have on students' well-being and children's well-being. And what she's finding, the interviews she's been doing over the last month, is that the children are really engaged with the program, and they actually feel like they are making a difference. And some of the kids who are suffering from eco-anxiety actually feel that they're contributing. They love their forests. And for some of the kids who are in year 6, who are moving on to year 7, they're sad to be leaving their forest behind, but the school said you can come back and visit your forest whenever you want. So these kids can come and see a legacy piece that they've put in. You know, they're helping to restore a natural system, and they're really enjoying it. And I think it's helping their mental well-being.
I would have thought practically every school in the country would be keen on this.
Every school should have some form of Miyawaki forest or bush classroom. So I'm working very closely with the Department of Education, statewide services. They have the Bush Classroom Initiative and the Two-Way Science Initiative, because our vision is to make sure that a kid has access to some kind of native vegetation, whether it be just a garden bed or a forest or some kind of bush classroom, where they can get in contact with nature, see what was on budja, what was on land before we cleared it, and just enjoy being in the natural world.
Given the name Miyawaki, have the Japanese recognised your work?
Yes. So what was cool last year was there's a first ever international symposium on Miyawaki forest. So I was one of the people who helped organise that. And that was in Yokohama University. And one of the main people organising was Professor Fujiwara. So she was Professor Miyawaki's foremost and best student. And she's absolutely incredible. She's an absolute powerhouse. And she's inspiring forest makers all around the world. And we had over 150 participants coming into Yokohama from all around the world. All these people creating Miyawaki forests, all sharing their stories, what's been happening, sharing the science. It was so brilliant to meet everyone, because all these people I've been talking with for years, and to actually see them in person was just brilliant. Yeah.
Incidentally, how long does it take to, depending on the state of the ground that you're dealing with, which could be a disused car park or something ghastly with all sorts of shit there and God knows what else, how long does it take to recover it, to bring in the compost and such light, so as the trees have got a good ground on which to grow?
So what we do is at the start of the school year, we get the kids involved in creating their own compost system. So this is really important because it teaches the kids about recycling their waste, making sure their food waste and things doesn't go into landfill. But importantly, it's part of the process of building their forest from the ground up. So we work together to create the compost over about 4 months. So I go back every week and work with the kids, you know, turning their compost, putting more stuff in, taking measurements, seeing, you know, what temperature it's at, you know, what animals are using it. So the kids can see that their waste scraps that would go into landfill are being used to develop their forest. And then basically all that goes into the forest soil before we plant, along with a whole bunch of other things like compost tea and now using biochar as well. That rejuvenates the soil so that we can create optimal conditions for the plants to grow. And then over the next few years, the forest itself breathes more life into that soil. So hopefully by year three, when the forest is, you know, self-sustaining, with all the leaf litter that's falling, it contributes all kinds of nutrients and, you know, all the animals you see teeming in the soil. It's just, so it's a relatively short period of time before we can rejuvenate the soil.
And are other nations following suit?
Yes, one of the things we're doing now is actually what I'm calling the Sister Forest Program, where we're linking children who are engaged in the program in Australia with different countries that are planting Miyawaki forests in schools as well. So one of the schools in Perth is now in the process of writing letters to a school in Tokyo, Montessori school there. So they're going to exchange letters talking about their forest, what they're seeing in their forest, pictures, poems, whatever they feel they want to contribute. And the students in Tokyo will send letters back to them, and then they'll have a video meetup where they can talk to each other through an interpreter. It's going to be absolutely fantastic. And one of the things the Tokyo kids are going to do is they're going to take the kids in Australia on a video journey with them when they go and harvest seaweed along the coastline that they're going to bring back to use as mulch for their forest. So Australian kids will travel with them virtually while they go and harvest this seaweed. It's going to be so amazing.
Congratulations. Thank you, Gray.
My pleasure. Always lovely to talk to you.
Dr. Gray Coupland, Harry Butler Institute, Murdoch University. This is The Science Show on Radio National with a programme on the good news, the momentum clearly apparent in WA. And next, someone who's been both an ABC top scientist and a WA Tall Poppy Award winner, Natasha Hurley-Walker. And here she is showing me the universe, or our part of it, the Milky Way, as I've never seen it before.
Natasha, where are we sitting at the moment? It looks like a vast area where you show films, but the films are completely different.
So this is the Curtin Hub for Immersive Visualisation and E-Research, or the Hive, as we like to call it. And yeah, it consists of different projection equipment.
Over where I'm sitting, I can see a long, long streak in a starry sky. What is the streak?
Well, the streak is our own Milky Way galaxy, but I'm going to have to correct you there, Robin, the phrase a starry sky. This is a fantastic image that we've made with the Murchison Wide Field Array, which is a radio telescope operating here in Western Australia. And it's been operating since 2013. Around the beginning of those operations, we undertook to survey the entire southern sky at these low radio frequencies, which was a little bit of a heroic task, but we were very successful. And so what we're looking at here is a combined mosaic of all of the observations that we took. And we are seeing in radio color. So the red colors here indicate the low radio frequencies, the green sort of in the middle, and the blue, the higher frequencies, although we don't really go that high. All of this is around the FM and digital TV kind of bands, which is why we built the telescope in the remote observatory. So the streak across the middle is our own Milky Way galaxy that we're inside. And so we're looking through it. And so what we're seeing is the accumulated radio emission as we look through the disk of our galaxy.
It's very beautiful. And it's part of your working astronomy, or is it part of a display to excite visitors like me?
I guess both, really. So this image contains a wealth of astrophysical information. So the colours are not just pretty. They are real radio colours. So what you can see in the plane is that we have these areas of red emission, and some of them are shaped like little spheres, little circles. And these are the remains of exploded stars, right? And this is how we tend to identify these supernova remnants. In the radio, a supernova explosion persists for hundreds of thousands of years. So by looking at an image like this, we can rewind the history of our galaxy and look at the births and deaths of stars from even millions of years ago. So one of the new supernova remnants that I discovered in this image exploded about 9,000 years ago and was only visible in the southern hemisphere. So I think that's quite amazing because the indigenous people here would have had a view of a huge explosion that would have lasted to the light, you know, for the optical light, about a month, and then it would have faded from view and they would have wondered what that was. And then nearly 10,000 years later, we build an observatory and we see that history and we know what it was. And I just love that connection that we've built going through space and time. It's really fabulous.
Just as a bit of a segue, I've just been to Liverpool in England, and there they've got the Liverpool telescope. And that, of course, was a false piece of information, because when I said there, it's actually on the Canary Islands.
Yes,
in other words, it's a robot. Mm. And it's trained to notice, as you said, something that suddenly happens, because most things up in the sky, as you're observing, take a zillion years and you don't notice any change. But if the robot is saying, hey, this guy went boing, all look there. And so you're doing it from a different kind of direction rather than the robot spotting it for you. You can spot it by having this lineup of the image writ large.
Yeah, so in some ways this is a sort of reference image. This is how the sky looked to the southern hemisphere in the radio waves in 2013, 2014. One of the really distinguishing features in this image is above and below that streak of our Milky Way galaxy are tens of thousands, even hundreds of thousands of these little dots. And you think, oh, okay, well, as you said, starry sky. But actually, each one of those is a distant galaxy. And of course, galaxies being large, they change on very slow timescales. And so these brightnesses that we're seeing here, they're not going to change for millions of years. So we've really captured the sky in this image.
And this is the point at which we turn around, and as you indicated in the beginning, a great big other image of something rather more intimate, if you like. And this relates to a paper you wrote, was it 3 years ago?
That's right, yeah. So once we have this reference image, we can, of course, look for things that change, like your robot on the Canaries. We, of course, actually didn't expect to see anything that changed because radio astronomy is a fairly mature science. People have been observing the sky with radio telescopes for almost 100 years now. And at these low frequencies, the prevailing wisdom was that nothing really changes. You see these radio galaxies, they just sit there. You see the Milky Way, it just sits there. You see these supernova remnants, they expand on timescales of tens of thousands of years. It's a fixed firmament, which we ever so slowly move through. And once you've done a radio survey, you're kind of finished. But I had an idea, which I just thought would be a bit of a technical challenge, a bit of fun, where when we were doing our follow-up survey, we needed to take more data in order to go deeper on the sky. So that means we revisit the same patch of sky more than once. And I thought it would just be an interesting technical challenge to just difference the two observations, see if anything changes. If anything does, it should pop out. And what we expected to do is there's this famous diagram in my field, which is just a series of downward pointing arrows, each one representing complete non-detection of transient radio objects. And the goal was maybe we could put a slightly lower downward pointing arrow on this diagram. But we did some differencing, and I worked with a very fantastic honors student, so just undergraduate, Tyrone O'Doherty. And we implemented this project, and oh my goodness, this bright source popped out. Something had changed in the radio sky. Tyrone was really great, wrote up a wonderful thesis, but he moved on to do a PhD with a different group. So it was kind of tasked to me to follow up this funny object and see what on earth had changed. And what was really odd was when I looked at the observations next to the detection of the object, it had disappeared again, which shouldn't happen. Nothing can change this quickly in the radio sky, right? I cannot emphasize enough that this is very, very weird behavior. So I thought, oh, we've made a mistake. It's an artifact. It's a satellite. It's an airplane. It's anything that not real. But an observation 18 minutes later popped up again. same place on the celestial sky. So, you know, when the sun goes overhead, the moon goes overhead, of course, that's the Earth's rotation. And this object was fixed to that sky, wasn't moving like an airplane or a satellite. And then it came back again. And then it came back again every 18 minutes.
But 18 minutes is not like a pulsar, which is quicker, isn't it?
That's right. So we do know about repeating radio pulsing sources like pulsars. We think, and all of our theories for the last 50 years have told us, that the only way they can generate radio waves is through rapid rotation. And indeed, as we see slow pulsars that rotate once every second or so, they become dim and intermittent and then they disappear. So seeing something that repeated every 18 minutes and each pulse at the time was the brightest radio source in that patch of sky. So outshining these radio galaxies, outshining our Milky Way, incredibly bright. That was a career-defining and life-defining moment. Unbelievable to see this in our data. And of course, we scrambled for explanation. Could this be some kind of signal from one of our own human-made probes? You know, where is Voyager? Nope, Voyager's nowhere nearby. Could this be some sort of hovering helicopter, really just messing with us? No. And eventually we realized, no, this is a real astrophysical signal. So it's actually still an ongoing mystery what these things are, but we have made a lot of progress in it.
So it's not an unusually sized neutron star?
One of the theories is that it could be a type of neutron star called a magnetar. So in a magnetar, it's like very, very, very highly magnetized. And the distortion of the magnetic fields, they could somehow collide to provide enough magnetic energy to drive this bright radio emission. Another theory that we have is that 18 minutes is actually not too unusual for the spin period of a very magnetic white dwarf. So neutron stars and white dwarfs are the different endpoints of different stellar masses. So big stars turn into black holes or neutron stars. Stars like our own sun eventually become white dwarfs. And so we're currently, I think, leaning towards the white dwarf hypothesis. We've had a lot of very interesting evidence come out and that we're about to publish sometime in the next couple of months. Yeah.
You found something and you're not going to tell me because it's embargoed.
Well, I can tell you about my student's very recent paper, which was just accepted to Nature Astronomy, wherein we'd seen that 18-minute repeating source, never saw it again. I've made a plan to find more of these things because there's always more. This is astronomy. You see a star, there's going to be a million more. And I found an object. And this one was repeating every 22 minutes. And what was actually very surprising was we went back through all of the archival telescopes data that had been observing that sky over the last 50 years. And amazingly, we found a detection as far back as 1988. So this source had been sitting there producing pulsations every 22 minutes for over 30 years. And we were the first to find it, which was, I think, very funny. So we had all of this data, and in our first paper, we pointed out the existence of the source. Well, this is astonishing, people. There are sources that are in your archives. You should go and have a look. But my student's paper that we just published, we did this very clever experiment where we observed the object with three different telescopes, MeerKAT, very large array in the United States, and ASCAP, which is a telescope we have here in Australia. So we had South Africa, the US, Australia, and we observed the source for 36 hours, handing over each observation. And my student took that data, put it together with all of the historical data, and realized, actually, there is a binary system, and the 22-minute pulsations are modulated by an 8.5-hour orbit, which means this is probably a star and a white dwarf in a very, very particular configuration. And it's amazing because we've done this. This source is 18,000 light years away. And yet just from the radio data, we have these very precise constraints on these two objects. And so we've just had that paper accepted to Nature Astronomy. It's very exciting.
It's very exciting indeed. Now, let's have a thought experiment. If you waited another million years and had another look, would they have crashed together?
That is a fabulous point. So you can lose energy in these orbits by all sorts of different mechanisms. You could have gravitational wave radiation, which of course is a very hot topic at the moment. You could have interactions between the systems and transfer of mass. That's one of the biggest things that slows these things down. The thing is that at the moment, what we can tell, because we can constrain the orbit very precisely, is there is no mass transfer. So neither of the objects are giving mass to the other one. And that means that the system should be very, very stable. We're not entirely sure how long, how these kinds of objects, these white dwarf pulsars, fit into stellar evolution is still a mystery. So we are working on that, and I hope maybe I'll have an answer for you in a couple of years.
Thank you so much, friend. Well done.
Thank you very much.
Associate Professor Natasha Hurley-Walker at Curtin University with another splendid discovery. She is such a star herself, and that imaging facility can also be adapted, would you believe, to show 3D images of shipwrecks filmed way down deep. Some of those images will be displayed at the National Maritime Museum in Sydney later this year, even showing on the sunken deck of the Titanic a blue necklace apparently dropped by a passenger who may or may not have survived. Two more thoughts, a last one from the West. Professor Peter Newman with his new book, Net Zero Cities with Sustainability, just out. And his building at Curtin says it all.
The Curtin Exchange complex, which includes this building, is a net zero development, which is extraordinary. It produces a lot of solar on its rooftops, which is not that unusual in Perth, but it also collects all the water that rains down on the buildings and on the gardens and directs it into a big tank, which is then used for all the student accommodation for laundry and those kind of things with water. Very effective. And the landscaping is extraordinary, beautifully done, but it follows two song lines that the Indigenous people helped us to work out how it fits into the story of this area.
How do you do architectural work with a song line?
Well, you do something that enables the water and the plant life and the bird life to be regenerated. And that has happened. There are 80 species of birds have come back to this area since that landscaping. And Damien Pericles, the landscaper, who's a terrific guy in this area, he should be lauded for what that did, because Indigenous people come back to see the bird life and say, yes, they're all saying this is what it should have been like. So it is a reflection on a major change that can happen in urban areas to say we are part of a Noongar culture as well as being all of this science and technology and so on that we do. So it says a lot.
And possibly looking around at the wonderful parks and gardens, does Josh Byrne advise on those?
Yes, Josh is a pretty important part of Curtin University these days, and he has been focusing on the sustainable development goals and how they fit with this place. So we've recently announced that we will be a net zero university by 2035 completely. So we are trying to be ahead of the game. And actually, there's been 20 years of very effective work going on quietly by the properties office here, who helped to do this big development without many people even knowing it was happening. Yeah. But it was a real partnership project with a lot of the private sector who wanted to do it as well. So there's a lot of benefits that come from doing net zero that are both economic and of great social benefit. You can show them.
Mentioning Josh Byrne, of course, if you want to see him, he's on Gardening Australia on Friday evenings and online, of course. And he's usually associated with a fair amount of compost. He gets his hands dirty and he does work up here as a professor as well. And in front of me is a book that he would know about very well. And it's written by Peter Newman, Net Zero Cities with Sustainability. Now, those things together, net zero and sustainability, reminds me of a certain Act of Parliament that's gone through. Is that possible?
Yeah, look, I think that does link in to the EPBC Act that we now have, which has taken 5 years to be delivered from the great Graham Samuels, who was one of the great public servants, I believe, because he came from a business background and wanted to bring those skills into it. But he also deeply felt what was needed for the environment. So bringing together environment and economic benefit together, that is the big agenda of our era. It is historic, because I've been in that business for 50 years. I started environmental science at Murdoch and then sustainable development with the sustainability strategy I did both in New South Wales and in WA, and also then brought to Curtin, and then happened net zero, which is the third phase, if you like, of this bringing together of environment and economic development. And I think it's the agenda that is quite historic and was reflected in all the speeches in Parliament, in all the goings on with the Greens, who have recognised they don't have to just wave a green flag. They can be quite sensible, and they call it being pragmatic, but it's actually just recognising that the economy needs the environment. And the environment needs the economy to work with it, not against it. And that integration and partnership is what I've been basically on about for a long time, but I've never seen it actually coming together so beautifully as it did. And so the 27th of November, I think, is a historic moment. And that's what the Prime Minister said when he actually announced that it had been delivered. He said, we now have the best example of how to do economic development with environmental protection. Both can be gainfully achieved. And that is what my book is trying to say. And it is showing how rapidly the net zero agenda is happening and showing that that is the future. So Trump has no possibility of winning because how can you possibly stop it? You can't. It's got everything right about it.
But you've got many people saying that you can't achieve zero emissions, net zero, and it doesn't make any bloody difference because Australia is too small an example. All sort of carping that goes on. What is the secret, as far as you're concerned, with things having come together? Is it the technological brilliance, the science involved? Is it the singing of Kumbaya and the warm inner glow? Or what? What's the secret?
I think we've come past the Kumbaya phase. I was part of that too, and it was kind of nice to sit around and say what we'd like to see in the 60s and 70s, that was. Look, it's happening. That's the reality. And it is happening because of the genius of science and technology, first of all, because the solar, batteries, electric vehicles, and the smart systems that integrate them are the most dramatic thing that's happening so fast that the energy transition data is now showing that this transformation is faster than at any other time in history.
And more on Peter Newman's book next week, Net Zero Cities with Sustainability. Also a feature on those electric vehicles he mentioned. Here's a taste.
I want to take you back in time, way back, well, 6 years ago, to when Prime Minister Scott Morrison said this.
Electric vehicles currently make up 0.2% of the vehicles market for new vehicles in Australia. And he believes he can take it to 50% in 10 years.
Actually, that was the figure for 2017. Even so, it seemed absurd at the time to think that electric vehicles would ever make a dent in the Australian car market. But that 0.2% has pretty much doubled every year since then. By 2023, electric vehicles were already 12% of the vehicles market, a 60-fold jump in just 4 years. So what happened?
Technology moves so fast, perhaps it was hard for someone like that to perceive something like this at a time like that. You're seeing more and more manufacturers perfecting things like battery chemical technology, the use of systems inside cars.
That was Scott Maynard, Managing Director of Polestar Australia. I met him at the auto show in Sydney, and what better place to find out how far EV technology has come in the last 6 years and overcome some of the problems and misconceptions, like safety concerns, range anxiety, and charging time.
Peter Hadfield, a summary of electric vehicles and 2026 on The Science Show next week.
And much more from me with two marine stories, how wind turbines may protect fish and the DNA of humpback whales.
Production by David Fisher and Belle Smith. I'm Robin Williams.
And I'm Belinda Smith.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.